hours. Recruits began yelling at each other to stop. The leader ordered a pause. He turned to the man behind him. "Watch my shoulders," he yelled through his gas mask. The leader shrugged his left shoulder and then his right. By watching the rhythm of the leader, the recruit behind him could coordinate how to lift the boards. The only problem with this idea was that it violated one of the ground rules. Recruits had been told they could not act until they heard a verbal command from their team leader. But with their gas masks on, no one could really hear anything. However, there was no other way to proceed. So the team leader began shrugging and swinging his arms while screaming orders. No one caught on at first, so he began yelling one of the songs they had learned on long marches. The recruit behind him could make out enough of what he was singing to join in. His neighbor did the same. Eventually, they were all singing and shrugging and swinging in tandem. They crossed the field in 28 minutes. Technically, we could send them back to start over, because each person didn't hear a direct verbal command from the team leader, a drill sergeant later told me. But that's the point of the exercise. We know you can't hear anything with the gas masks on. The only way to get across the pit is to figure out some workaround. We're trying to teach them that you can't just obey orders. You have to take control and figure things out for yourself. 24 hours and another dozen obstacles later, Quintanilla's platoon gathered at the base of the crucible's final challenge, a long, steep hill they called the Grim Reaper. "You don't have to help each other during the Reaper," Krulak said. "I've seen that happen before. Recruits fall down and they don't have buddies, so they get left behind." Quintanilla had been marching for 2 days by this point. He had slept less than 4 hours. His face was numb, and his hands were covered with blisters and cuts from carrying water-filled drums across obstacles. "There were guys throwing up at the Reaper," he told me. "One person had his arm in a sling." As the group began walking up the mountain, recruits kept stumbling. They were all so exhausted they moved as if in slow motion, hardly making any progress. So they began linking up, arm in arm, to prevent one another from sliding down the incline. "Why are you doing this?" Quintanilla's pack buddy wheezed at him, lapsing into a call and response they had practiced on hikes. "When things are at their most miserable," their drill instructors had said, "they should ask each other questions that begin with why." "To become a Marine and build a better life for my family," Quintanilla said. His wife had given birth a week earlier to a daughter, Zoe. He had been allowed to speak to her for a total of 5 minutes by telephone after the delivery. It was his only contact with the outside world in almost 2 months. If he finished the crucible, he would see his wife and new child. If you can link something hard to a choice you care about, it makes the task easier, Quintanilla's drill instructors had told him. That's why they asked each other questions starting with why. Make a chore into a meaningful decision, and self-motivation will emerge. The platoon summited the last peak as the sun crested and staggered to a clearing with a flagpole. Everyone went still. They were finally done. The crucible was over. A drill instructor walked through their formation, pausing before each man to place the service's insignia, the eagle, globe, and anchor, in their hands. They were officially Marines. "You think boot camp is going to be all screaming and fighting," Quintanilla told me. "But it's not. It's not like that at all. It's more about learning how to make yourself do things you thought you couldn't do. It's really emotional, actually." Basic training, like the Marine Corps career itself, offers few material rewards. A Marine's starting salary is $17,616 a year. However, the Corps has one of the highest career satisfaction rates. The training the Corps provides to roughly 40,000 recruits each year has transformed the lives of millions of people who, like Quintanilla, had no idea how to generate the motivation and self-direction needed to take control of their lives. Since CRULAC's reforms, the Corps' retention of new recruits and the performance scores of new Marines have both increased by more than 20%. Surveys indicate that the average recruit's internal locus of control increases significantly during basic training. Delgado's experiments were a start to understanding motivation. The Marines complement those insights by helping us understand how to teach drive to people who aren't practiced in self-determination. If you give people an opportunity to feel a sense of control and let them practice making choices, they can learn to exert willpower. Once people know how to make self-directed choices into a habit, motivation becomes more automatic. Moreover, to teach ourselves to self-motivate more easily, we need to learn to see our choices not just as expressions of control, but also as affirmations of our values and goals. That's the reason recruits ask each other why, because it shows them how to link small tasks to larger aspirations. The significance of this insight can be seen in a series of studies conducted in nursing homes in the 1990s. Researchers were studying why some seniors thrived inside such facilities, while others experienced rapid physical and mental declines. A critical difference, the researchers determined, was that the seniors who flourished made choices that rebelled against the rigid schedules, set menus, and strict rules that the nursing homes tried to force upon them. Some researchers referred to such residents as subversives, because so many of their decisions manifested as small rebellions against the status quo. One group at a Santa Fe nursing home, for instance, started every meal by trading food items among themselves in order to construct meals of their own design, rather than placidly accept what had been served to them. One resident told a researcher that he always gave his cake away, because, even though he liked cake, he would rather eat a second-class meal that I have chosen. A group of residents at a nursing home in Little Rock violated the institution's rules by moving furniture around to personalize their bedrooms. Because wardrobes were attached to the walls, they used a crowbar, appropriated from a tool closet, to wrench their dressers free. In response, an administrator called a meeting and said there was no need to undertake independent redecorations. If the residents needed help, the staff would provide it. The residents informed the administrator that they didn't want any assistance, didn't need permission, and intended to continue doing whatever they damn well pleased. These small acts of defiance were, in the grand scheme of things, relatively minor. But they were psychologically powerful, because the subversives saw the rebellions as evidence that they were still in control of their own lives. The subversives walked, on average, about twice as much as other nursing home residents. They ate about a third more. They were better at complying with doctor's orders, taking their medications, visiting the gym, and maintaining relationships with family and friends. These residents had arrived at the nursing homes with just as many health problems as their peers, but once inside, they lived longer, reported higher levels of happiness, and were far more active and intellectually engaged. It's the difference between making decisions that prove to yourself that you're still in charge of your life versus falling into a mindset where you're just waiting to die, said Rosalie Kane, a gerontologist at the University of Minnesota. It doesn't really matter if you eat cake or not, but if you refuse to eat their cake, you're demonstrating to yourself that you're still in charge. The subversives thrived because they knew how to take control, the same way that Quintanilla's troop learned to subversively cross a pit during the crucible by deciding on their own how to interpret the rules. The choices that are most powerful in generating motivation, in other words, are decisions that do two things. They convince us we're in control, and they endow our actions with larger meaning. Choosing to climb a mountain can become an articulation of love for a daughter. Deciding to stage a nursing home insurrection can become proof that you're still alive. An internal locus of control emerges when we develop a mental habit of transforming chores into meaningful choices, when we assert that we have authority over our lives. Quintanilla finished boot camp in 2010 and served in the Corps for 3 years. He then left. He was finally ready, he felt, for real life. He got another job, but the lack of camaraderie among his colleagues was disappointing. No one seemed motivated to excel. So in 2015, he re-enlisted. "I missed that constant reminder that I can do anything," he told me. "I missed people pushing me to choose a better me." 5. Viola Philippi, the wife of the one-time auto parts tycoon of Louisiana, was something of an expert on motivation herself before she and Robert flew to South America. She had been born with albinism. Her body did not produce the enzyme tyrosinase, critical in the production of melanin. And as a result, her skin, hair, and eyes contained no pigment, and her eyesight was poor. She was legally blind, and could read only by putting her face very close to a page and using a magnifying glass. "You have never met a more determined person, though," her daughter Roxanne told me. "She could do anything." When Viola was a girl, the school district had tried to put her into remedial classes, despite the fact that it was her eyes, not her brain, that had problems. But she refused to leave the classroom where her friends sat. She stayed in that room until administrators relented. After she graduated, she went to Louisiana State University and told the school she expected them to provide someone to read textbooks to her aloud. The school complied. During her sophomore year, she met Robert, who soon dropped out to start washing and greasing cars for a local Ford dealer. He encouraged her to quit school as well. She politely declined and got her degree. They were married in December 1950, 4 months after she graduated. They had 6 children in rapid succession, and while Robert built his empire, Viola ran the household. There were morning meetings and charts showing what each child had to accomplish each day. There were Friday night check-ins, during which everyone laid out their goals for the coming week. "They were like 2 peas in a pod, both totally driven," said Roxanne. "Mom refused to let her disabilities stop her. I think that's why it was so hard for her when Dad changed." When Robert's apathy took hold, Viola initially focused her energy on caring for him. She hired nurses to help him exercise and worked with his brother to form a committee to oversee and then sell off Robert's companies. After a while, however, she ran out of things to do. She had married a bon vivant, a man so full of life that it was hard to go to the grocery store because he constantly stopped to chat with everyone. Now Robert sat in a chair in front of the television all day. Viola was miserable. "He didn't speak to me," she told a courtroom when the family sued for insurance money they felt owed because of Robert's neurological injuries. It didn't seem like he was interested in anything I did. You know, I would fix his meals and I was more or less a caretaker. I guess you would call me a caretaker." For a few years, she felt sorry for herself. Then she became angry. Then busy. If Robert wasn't going to show any motivation to reclaim his life, then she would force him to get moving again. She would make him engage. She began by asking him ceaseless questions. When she made lunch, she would pepper him with choices. Sandwich or soup? Lettuce or tomato? Ham or turkey? What about mayonnaise? Ice water or juice? She didn't really mean anything by it at first. She was just frustrated and wanted to make him speak. But then, after a few months of harassing him, Viola found that whenever Robert was pressured into making decisions, he seemed to come out of his shell a little bit. He would banter with her for a few moments, or tell her about a program he had been watching. One night, after she had forced him to make a dozen choices about what he was going to eat, and which table they should sit at, and what music to listen to, he began talking at length, reminding her of a funny story from after they had gotten married, when they had locked themselves out of the house in a rainstorm. He told the story in an offhand way, and chuckled as he recalled trying to jimmy a window. It was the first time Viola had heard him laugh in years. For a few minutes, it was like the old Robert was back. Then he faced the TV and went silent again. Viola continued her campaign, and over time, more and more of the old Robert emerged. Viola congratulated, cajoled, and rewarded him whenever he seemed, for a moment, like his former self. When he went back to Dr. Strube, the neurologist in New Orleans, for his annual checkup 7 years after the trip to South America, the doctor could see the difference. He was saying hello to the nurses and asking them about their kids, Dr. Strube said. He would initiate conversations with me, ask about my hobbies. He had opinions on the routes they should drive to get home. It was stuff you wouldn't have noticed with anyone else, but with him, it was like someone was turning on the lights again. As neurologists have studied how motivation functions within our brains, they've become increasingly convinced that people like Robert don't lose their drive because they've lost the capacity for self-motivation. Rather, their apathy is due to an emotional dysfunction. One of the things Habib, the French researcher, noticed about all the people he studied was that they shared an odd emotional detachment. One apathetic woman told him she had hardly reacted when her father died. A man said he hadn't felt the urge to hug his wife or children since the passivity had taken hold. When Habib asked patients if they felt sad about how much their lives had changed, they all said no. They didn't feel anything. Neurologists have suggested that this emotional numbness is why some people feel no motivation. Among Habib's patients, the injuries in their striata prevented them from feeling the sense of reward that comes from taking control. Their motivation went dormant because they had forgotten how good it feels to make a choice. In other situations, it's that people have never learned what it feels like to be self-determined because they have grown up in a neighborhood that seems to offer so few choices, or they have forgotten the rewards of autonomy since they've moved into a nursing home. This theory suggests how we can help ourselves and others strengthen our internal locus of control. We should reward initiative, congratulate people for self-motivation, celebrate when an infant wants to feed herself. We should applaud a child who shows defiant, self-righteous stubbornness and reward a student who finds a way to get things done by working around the rules. This is easier in theory, of course, than practice. We all applaud self-motivation until a toddler won't put on his shoes, an aged parent is ripping a dresser out of the wall, or a teenager ignores the rules. But that's how an internal locus of control becomes stronger. That's how our mind learns and remembers how good it feels to be in control. And unless we practice self-determination and give ourselves emotional rewards for subversive assertiveness, our capacity for self-motivation can fade. What's more, we need to prove to ourselves that our choices are meaningful. When we start a new task or confront an unpleasant chore, we should take a moment to ask ourselves why. Why are we forcing ourselves to climb up this hill? Why are we pushing ourselves to walk away from the television? Why is it so important to return that email or deal with a coworker whose requests seem so unimportant? Once we start asking why, those small tasks become pieces of a larger constellation of meaningful projects, goals, and values. We start to recognize how small chores can have outsized emotional rewards, because they prove to ourselves that we are making meaningful choices, that we are genuinely in control of our own lives. That's when self-motivation flourishes. When we realize that replying to an email or helping a coworker on its own might be relatively unimportant. But it is part of a bigger project that we believe in, that we want to achieve, that we have chosen to do. Self-motivation, in other words, is a choice we make because it is part of something bigger and more emotionally rewarding than the immediate task that needs doing. In 2010, 22 years after her South American vacation with Robert, Viola was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. It took 2 years for the disease to consume her. At every step, Robert was there, helping her out of bed in the morning and reminding her to take her medications at night. He asked her questions to distract her from the pain and fed her when she became feeble. When Viola finally passed, Robert sat by her empty bed for days. His children, worried he was slipping back into apathy, suggested another visit with a neurologist in New Orleans. Perhaps the doctor would recommend something to forestall his listlessness from returning. "No," Robert replied. "It wasn't apathy keeping him indoors. He just needed some time to reflect on 62 years of marriage." Viola had helped Robert build a life. And then, when everything had slipped from his grasp, she helped him rebuild it again. He just wanted to honor that by pausing for a few days, he told his kids. A week later, he left the house and came over for brunch. Afterward, he babysat his grandchildren. Robert passed away 24 months later, in 2014. "He was active," his obituary noted, "until the end." Chapter 2. Teams. Psychological safety at Google and Saturday Night Live. Julia Rozovsky was 25 years old and uncertain what to do with her life when she decided it was time for a change. She was a Tufts graduate with a bachelor's degree in math and economics who had previously worked at a consulting firm, which she found unfulfilling. Then she had become a researcher for two professors at Harvard, which was fun, but not a long-term career. Maybe, she thought, she belonged in a big corporation. Or perhaps she ought to become an academic. Or maybe she should join a tech startup. It was all very confusing to her. So she picked the option that meant she didn't have to decide. She applied to business schools and was accepted to start at the Yale School of Management in 2010. She showed up in New Haven ready to bond with her classmates and, like all new students, was assigned to a study group. This group, she figured, would be an important part of her education. They would become close friends and learn together, debate important issues, and discover, with each other's help, who they were meant to be. Study groups are a rite of passage at most MBA programs, a way for students to practice working in teams. At Yale, each study group shares the same class schedule and collaborates on each group assignment, one of the school's websites explained. Study groups have been carefully constructed to bring together students with diverse backgrounds, both professionally and culturally. Each day during lunch or after dinner, Julia and the four other members of her study group would gather to discuss homework and compare spreadsheets, strategize for upcoming exams, and trade lecture notes. Truth be told, her group wasn't all that diverse. Two of them had been management consultants like Julia. Another had worked at a startup. They were all smart and curious and outgoing. Their similarity, she hoped, would make it easy for them to bond. "There are lots of people who say some of their best business school friends come from their study groups," said Julia. "But it wasn't like that for me." Almost from the start, study group felt like a daily dose of stress. "I never felt completely relaxed," she told me. "I always felt like I had to prove myself." Dynamics quickly emerged that put her on edge. Everyone wanted to show they were leaders, and so when teachers issued study group assignments, there were subtle tussles over who was in charge. People would try to show authority by speaking louder or talking over each other, Julia said. When it came to divvying up tasks for projects, one group member would sometimes preemptively assign roles, and then the others would critique those assignments, and then someone else would claim authority over some part of the project, and then everyone else would rush to grab their own piece. "Maybe it was my own insecurities, but I always felt like I had to be careful not to make mistakes around them," said Julia. "People were critical of each other, but they would play it off like they were making a joke, and so the group was kind of passive-aggressive. I was looking forward to making friends with my group," she said. "It really bummed me out that we didn't gel." So Julia started looking for other groups to join, other ways to connect with classmates. One person mentioned that some students were putting together a team to participate in case competitions, in which business school students proposed innovative solutions to real-world business problems. Teams would receive a case study, spend a few weeks writing a business plan, and then submit it to high-profile executives and professors who picked the winner. Companies sponsored these contests, and there were cash prizes, as well as, sometimes, jobs that came out of the competitions. Julia signed up. Yale hosted about a dozen different case competition teams. The one Julia joined included a former Army officer, a think tank researcher, the director of a health education nonprofit, and a refugee program manager. Unlike her study group, everyone was from different backgrounds. From the start, though, they all clicked. Each time a new case arrived, the team would gather in the library and dive into action, spending hours brainstorming options, assigning research duties, and divvying up writing assignments. Then they would meet again and again and again. "One of the best cases we did was about Yale itself," Julia said. "There had always been a student-run snack store, but the university was taking over food sales, and so the business school sponsored a contest to overhaul the shop. We met every night for a week. I thought we should fill the shop with nap pods, and someone else said it should become a game room. And there was also some kind of clothing swap idea. We had lots of crazy ideas." No one ever shot down a suggestion, not even the nap pods. Julia's study group, as part of their class assignments, had also engaged in a fair amount of brainstorming. But if I had ever mentioned something like a nap pod, somebody would have rolled their eyes and come up with 15 reasons why it was a dumb idea. And it was a dumb idea. But my case team loved it. We always loved each other's dumb ideas. We spent an hour figuring out how nap pods could make money by selling accessories like earplugs. Eventually, Julia's case team settled on the idea of converting the student shop into a micro gym with a handful of exercise classes and a few workout machines. They spent weeks researching pricing models and contacting equipment manufacturers. They won the competition, and the micro gym exists today. That same year, Julia's case team spent another month studying ways for a chain of eco-friendly convenience stores to expand into North Carolina. "We must have analyzed 2 dozen plans," she said. "A lot of them turned out not to make any sense." When the team traveled to Portland, Oregon to present their final suggestion, a slow-growth approach that emphasized the chain's healthy food options, they placed first in the nation. Julia's study group dissolved sometime in her second semester after one person and then another and then everyone stopped showing up. The case competition team grew as new students asked if they could join. The core group of 5 teammates, including Julia, remained involved the entire time they were at Yale. Today, these people are some of her closest friends. They attend one another's weddings and visit each other when traveling. They call each other for career advice and pass along job leads. It always struck Julia as odd that those two teams felt so different. Her study group felt stressful because everyone was always jousting for leadership and critiquing each other's ideas. Her case competition team felt exciting because everyone was so supportive and enthusiastic. Both groups, however, were composed of basically the same kinds of people. They were all bright, and everyone was friendly outside of the team settings. There was no reason why the dynamic inside Julia's study group needed to become so competitive, while the culture of the case team was so easygoing. "I couldn't figure out why things had turned out so different," Julia told me. "It didn't seem like it had to happen that way." After graduation, Julia went to work at Google and joined its People Analytics Group, which was tasked with studying nearly every aspect of how employees spent their time. What she was supposed to do with her life, it turned out, was use data to figure out why people behave in certain ways. For 6 years running, Google had been ranked by Fortune as one of America's top workplaces. The company's executives believed that was because, even as it had grown to 53,000 employees, Google had devoted enormous resources to studying workers' happiness and productivity. The People Analytics Group, part of Google's Human Resources Division, helped examine if employees were satisfied with their bosses and coworkers, whether they felt overworked, intellectually challenged, and fairly paid, whether their work-life balance was actually balancing out, as well as hundreds of other variables. The division helped with hiring and firing decisions, and its analysts provided insights into who should be promoted and who, perhaps, had risen too fast. In the years before Julia joined the group, People Analytics had determined that Google needed to interview a job applicant only 4 times to predict, with 86% confidence, if they would be a good hire. The division had successfully pushed to increase paid maternity leave from 12 to 18 weeks because computer models indicated that would reduce the frequency of new mothers quitting by 50%. At the most basic level, the division's goal was to make life at Google a little bit better and a lot more productive. With enough data, People Analytics believed, almost any behavioral puzzle could be solved. People Analytics' biggest undertaking in recent years had been a study, codenamed Project Oxygen before it was revealed, that examined why some managers were more effective than others. Ultimately, researchers had identified 8 critical management skills. Project Oxygen found that a good manager, 1, is a good coach, 2, empowers and does not micromanage, 3, expresses interest and concern in subordinate success and well-being, 4, is results-oriented, 5, listens and shares information, 6, helps with career development, 7, has a clear vision and strategy, 8, has key technical skills. "Oxygen was a huge success for us," said Abir Dubey, a People Analytics manager. It helped clarify what differentiated good managers from everyone else, and how we could help people improve. The project was so useful, in fact, that at about the same time Julia was hired, Google began another massive effort, this one codenamed Project Aristotle. Dubé and his colleagues had noticed that many Google employees, in company surveys, had consistently mentioned the importance of their teams. Googlers would say things like, "I have a great manager, but my team has never clicked," or, "My manager isn't fantastic, but the team is so strong it doesn't matter," said Dubé. And that was kind of eye-opening, because Project Oxygen had looked at leadership, but it hadn't focused on how teams function, or if there's an optimal mix of different kinds of people or backgrounds. Dubé and his colleagues wanted to figure out how to build the perfect team. Julia became one of the effort's researchers. The project started with a sweeping review of academic literature. Some scientists had found that teams functioned best when they contained a concentration of people with similar levels of extroversion and introversion, while others had found that a balance of personalities was key. There were studies about the importance of teammates having similar tastes and hobbies, and others lauding diversity within groups. Some research suggested that teams needed people who liked to collaborate. Others said groups were more successful when individuals had healthy rivalries. The literature, in other words, was all over the place. So Project Aristotle spent more than 150 hours asking Google employees what they thought made a team effective. "We learned that teams are somewhat in the eye of the beholder," said Dubé. "One group might appear like it's working really well from the outside, but inside, everyone is miserable." Eventually, they established criteria for measuring teams' effectiveness based on external factors, such as whether a group hit their sales targets, as well as internal variables, such as how productive team members felt. Then the Aristotle group began measuring everything they could. Researchers examined how often teammates socialized outside of work, and how members divided up tasks. They drew complicated diagrams to show teams' overlapping memberships, and then compared those against statistics of which groups had exceeded their department's goals. They studied how long teams stuck together, and if gender balance had an impact on effectiveness. No matter how they arranged the data, though, it was almost impossible to find patterns, or any evidence that a team's composition was correlated with its success. "We looked at 180 teams from all over the company," said Dubé. "We had lots of data, but there was nothing showing that a mix of specific personality types or skills or backgrounds made any difference. The who part of the equation didn't seem to matter." Some productive Google teams, for instance, were composed of friends who played sports together outside of work. Others were made up of people who were basically strangers away from the conference room. Some groups preferred strong managers. Others wanted a flatter structure. Most confounding of all, sometimes two teams would have nearly identical compositions with overlapping memberships, but radically different levels of effectiveness. "At Google, we're good at finding patterns," said Dubé. "There weren't strong patterns here." So Project Aristotle turned to a different approach. There was a second body of academic research that focused on what are known as group norms. Any group, over time, develops collective norms about appropriate behavior, a team of psychologists had written in the Sociology of Sport journal. Norms are the traditions, behavioral standards, and unwritten rules that govern how we function. When a team comes to an unspoken consensus that avoiding disagreement is more valuable than debate, that's a norm asserting itself. If a team develops a culture that encourages differences of opinion and spurns groupthink, That's another norm holding sway. Team members might behave certain ways as individuals. They may chafe against authority or prefer working independently. But often, inside a group, there's a set of norms that override those preferences and encourage deference to the team. The Project Aristotle researchers went back to their data and analyzed it again, this time looking for norms. They found that some teams consistently allowed people to interrupt one another. Others enforced taking conversational turns. Some teams celebrated birthdays and began each meeting with a few minutes of informal chit-chat. Others got right to business. There were teams that contained extroverts who hewed to the group's sedate norms whenever they assembled, and others where introverts came out of their shells as soon as meetings began. And some norms, the data indicated, consistently correlated with high team effectiveness. One engineer, for instance, told the researchers that his team leader is direct and straightforward, which creates a safe space for you to take risks. She also takes the time to ask how we are, figure out how she can help you and support you. That was one of the most effective groups inside Google. Alternately, another engineer told the researchers that his team leader has poor emotional control. He panics over small issues and keeps trying to grab control. I would hate to be driving with him in the passenger seat, because he would keep trying to grab the steering wheel and crash the car. That team did not perform well. Most of all, though, employees talked about how various teams felt. And that made a lot of sense to me, maybe because of my experiences at Yale, Julia said. I'd been on some teams that left me feeling totally exhausted, and others where I got so much energy from the group. There is strong evidence that group norms play a critical role in shaping the emotional experience of participating in a team. Research by psychologists from Yale, Harvard, Berkeley, the University of Oregon, and elsewhere indicate that norms determine whether we feel safe or threatened, enervated or excited, and motivated or discouraged by our teammates. Julia's study group at Yale, for instance, felt draining because the norms, the tussles over leadership, the pressure to constantly demonstrate expertise, the tendency to critique, had put her on guard. In contrast, the norms of her case competition team, enthusiasm for one another's ideas, withholding criticisms, encouraging people to take a leadership role or hang back as they wanted, allowed everyone to be friendly and unconstrained. Coordination was easy. Group norms, the researchers on Project Aristotle concluded, were the answer to improving Google's teams. The data finally started making sense, said Dubay. We had to manage the how of teams, not the who. The question, however, was which norms mattered most. Google's research had identified dozens of norms that seemed important, and sometimes the norms of one effective team contradicted the norms of another equally successful group. Was it better to let everyone speak as much as they wanted, or should strong leaders end meandering debates? Was it more effective for people to openly disagree with one another, or should conflicts be downplayed? Which norms were most crucial? 2. In 1991, a first-year PhD student named Amy Edmondson began visiting hospital wards, intending to show that good teamwork and good medicine went hand in hand. But the data kept saying she was wrong. Edmondson was studying organizational behavior at Harvard. A professor had asked her to help with a study of medical mistakes, and so Edmondson, on the prowl for a dissertation topic, started visiting recovery rooms, talking to nurses, and paging through error reports from two Boston hospitals. In one cardiac ward, she discovered that a nurse had accidentally given a patient an IV of lidocaine, an anesthetic, rather than heparin, a blood thinner. In an orthopedic ward, a patient was given amphetamines rather than aspirin. You would be shocked at how many mistakes occur every day, Edmondson told me. Not because of incompetence, but because hospitals are really complicated places, and there's usually a large team, as many as 24 nurses and techs and doctors, who might be involved in each patient's care. That's a lot of opportunities for something to slip through the cracks. Some parts of the hospitals Edmondson visited seemed more accident-prone than others. The orthopedic ward, for instance, reported an average of one error every 3 weeks. The cardiac ward, on the other hand, reported a mistake almost every other day. Edmondson also found that the various departments had very different cultures. In the cardiac ward, nurses were chatty and informal. They gossiped in the hallways and had pictures of their kids on the walls. In orthopedics, people were more sedate. Nurse managers wore business suits rather than scrubs and asked everyone to keep the public areas free of personal items and clutter. Perhaps, Edmondson thought, she could study the various teams' cultures and see if they correlated with error rates. She and a colleague created a survey to measure team cohesion on various wards. She asked nurses to describe how frequently their team leaders set clear goals and whether teammates discussed conflicts openly or avoided tense conversations. She measured the satisfaction, happiness, and self-motivation of different groups and hired a research assistant to observe the wards for 2 months. I figured it would be pretty straightforward, Edmondson told me. The units with the strongest sense of teamwork would have the lowest error rates. Except, when she tabulated her data, Edmondson found exactly the opposite. The wards with the strongest team cohesion had far more errors. She checked the data again. It didn't make any sense. Why would strong teams make more mistakes? Confused, Edmondson decided to look at these nurses' responses, question by question, alongside the error rates, to see if any explanations emerged. Edmondson had included one survey question that inquired specifically about the personal risks associated with making errors. She asked people to agree or disagree with the statement, "If you make a mistake in this unit, it is held against you." Once she compared the data from that question with error incidents, she realized what was going on. It wasn't that wards with strong teams were making more mistakes. Rather, it was that nurses who belonged to strong teams felt more comfortable reporting their mistakes. The data indicated that one particular norm, whether people were punished for missteps, influenced if they were honest after they screwed up. Some leaders have established a climate of openness that facilitates discussion of error, which is likely to be an important influence on detected error rates, Edmondson wrote in the Journal of Applied Behavioral Science in 1996. What particularly surprised her, however, was how complicated things got the closer she looked. It wasn't simply that strong teams encouraged open communication and weak teams discouraged it. In fact, while some strong teams emboldened people to admit their mistakes, other, equally strong teams made it hard for nurses to speak up. What made the difference wasn't team cohesion. Rather, it was the culture each team established. In one ward with a strong team, for instance, nurses were overseen by a hands-on manager who actively invites questions and concerns. In an interview, the nurse manager explains that a certain level of error will occur, so a non-punitive environment is essential to deal with this error productively, Edmondson wrote. There is an unspoken rule here to help each other and check each other, a nurse told Edmondson's assistant. People feel more willing to admit to errors here because the nurse manager goes to bat for you. In another ward with a team that, at first glance, seemed equally strong, a nurse said that when she admitted hurting a patient while drawing blood, the nurse manager made her feel like she was on trial. Another said doctors bite your head off if you make a mistake. Yet measurements of group cohesion on this ward were still very high. A nurse told the research assistant that the ward prides itself on being clean, neat, and having an appearance of professionalism. The nurse manager for the ward dressed in business suits, and when she delivered criticism, she considerately offered her critiques behind closed doors. The staff said they appreciated the manager's professionalism, were proud of their department, and felt a strong sense of unity. To Edmondson, the team seemed like they genuinely liked and respected one another. But they also admitted that the unit's culture sometimes made it hard to confess making a mistake. It wasn't the strength of the team that determined how many errors were reported. Rather, it was one specific norm. When Edmondson started working on her dissertation, she visited technology companies and factory floors and asked people about the unwritten rules that shaped how their teammates behaved. People would say things like, "This is one of the best teams I've ever been on because I don't have to wear a work face here," or, "We aren't afraid to share crazy ideas," Edmondson told me. On those teams, norms of enthusiasm and support had taken hold, and everyone felt empowered to voice opinions and take risks. And other teams would tell me, "My group is really dedicated to each other, and so I try not to go outside my department without checking with my supervisor first." Or, "We're all in this together, so I don't like to bring up an idea unless I know it will work." Within those teams, a norm of loyalty held sway, and it undermined people's willingness to make suggestions or take chances. Both enthusiasm and loyalty are admirable norms. It wasn't clear to managers that they would have such different impacts on people's behaviors. And yet they did. In that setting, enthusiastic norms made teams better. Loyalty norms made them less effective. "Managers never intend to create unhealthy norms," Edmondson said. "Sometimes, though, they make choices that seem logical, like encouraging people to flesh out their ideas before presenting them, that ultimately undermine a team's ability to work together." As her research continued, Edmondson found a handful of good norms that seemed to be consistently associated with higher productivity. On the best teams, for instance, leaders encouraged people to speak up. Teammates felt like they could expose their vulnerabilities to one another. People said they could suggest ideas without fear of retribution. The culture discouraged people from making harsh judgments. As Edmondson's list of good norms grew, she began to notice that everything shared a common attribute. They were all behaviors that created a sense of togetherness while also encouraging people to take a chance. "We call it psychological safety," she said. Psychological safety is a shared belief held by members of a team that the group is a safe place for taking risks. It is a sense of confidence that the team will not embarrass, reject, or punish someone for speaking up, Edmondson wrote in a 1999 paper. It describes a team climate characterized by interpersonal trust and mutual respect in which people are comfortable being themselves. Julia and her Google colleagues found Edmondson's papers as they were researching norms. The idea of psychological safety, they felt, captured everything their data indicated was important to Google's teams. The norms that Google's surveys said were most effective, allowing others to fail without repercussions, respecting divergent opinions, feeling free to question others' choices, but also trusting that people aren't trying to undermine you, were all aspects of feeling psychologically safe at work. It was clear to us that this idea of psychological safety was pointing to which norms were most important, said Julia. But it wasn't clear how to teach those inside Google. "People here are really busy. We needed clear guidelines for creating psychological safety without losing the capacity for dissent and debate that's critical to how Google functions. In other words, how do you convince people to feel safe while also encouraging them to be willing to disagree? For a long time, that was the million-dollar question, Edmondson told me. We knew it was important for teammates to be open with each other. We knew it was important for people to feel like they can speak up if something's wrong. But those are also the behaviors that can set people at odds. We didn't know why some groups could clash and still have psychological safety, while others would hit a period of conflict and everything would fall apart. 3. On the first day of auditions for the television show that became known as Saturday Night Live, the actors showed up, one after another, hour after hour, until it felt like it would never stop. There were two women who played Midwestern housewives preparing for the annual meteorological disaster. "Can I borrow your centerpiece for the tornado this year?" And a singer with an original composition named "I Am Dog," lampooning the women's liberation anthem, "I Am Woman." A roller-skating impressionist and an obscure musician named Meatloaf took the stage around lunchtime. The actor Morgan Freeman and the comic Larry David were on the call sheet, as were four jugglers and five mimes. To the exhausted observers watching the auditions, it felt as if every vaudeville act and stand-up comedian between Boston and Washington, D.C. had shown up. Which is the way the show's 30-year-old creator, Lorne Michaels, wanted it. Over the previous 9 months, Michaels had traveled from Bangor to San Diego, watching hundreds of comedy club shows. He talked to writers from television and radio programs and every magazine with a humor page. His goal, he later said, was to see every single funny person in North America. By noon on the second day of auditions, tryouts were running late when a man burst through the doors, leapt onto the stage, and demanded the producer's attention. He had a trim mustache and wore a three-piece suit. He carried a folded umbrella and an attaché. "I've been waiting out there for 3 hours, and I'm not going to wait anymore," he shouted. "I'm going to miss my plane." He marched across the stage. "That's it. You've had your chance. Good day." Then he stormed out. "What the hell was that?" one producer asked. "Oh, that was just Danny Aykroyd," said Michaels. They had known each other in Toronto, where Aykroyd was a student in Michaels's improv class. "He's probably going to do the show," Michaels said. Over the next month, as Michaels chose the rest of the cast, the same thing happened again and again. Instead of picking from among the hundreds of people he auditioned, Michaels hired comedians he already knew or who had been recommended by friends. Michaels knew Aykroyd from Canada, and Aykroyd, in turn, was enthusiastic about a guy named John Belushi he had met in Chicago. Belushi initially said he'd never appear on television because it was a crass medium, but he recommended a castmate from the National Lampoon show named Gilda Radner, who Michaels, it turned out, had already hired. They knew each other from Godspell. The National Lampoon show was affiliated with National Lampoon magazine, which was founded by the writer Michael O'Donohue, who lived with another comedy writer named Ann Beats. All of these people created the first season of Saturday Night Live. Howard Shore, the show's music director, had gone to summer camp with Michaels. Neil Levy, the show's talent coordinator, was Michaels's cousin. Michaels had met Chevy Chase while standing in a line in Hollywood to see Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Tom Schiller, another writer, knew Michaels because they had gone to Joshua Tree to eat hallucinogenic mushrooms together. And Schiller's father, a Hollywood writer, had taken Michaels under his wing early in the young man's career. The original cast and writers of Saturday Night Live hailed largely from Canada, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and all moved to New York in 1975. "Manhattan was a show business wasteland then," said Marilyn Suzanne Miller, a writer whom Michaels hired after they collaborated on a Lily Tomlin special in L.A. It was like Lorne had deposited us on Mars. When most of the staff got to New York, they didn't know anyone except one another.